everybody. Welcome back to Radio Imbibe from Imbibe Magazine. I'm Paul Clark, Imbibe's editor-in-chief. And maybe you work in the bar industry, or you're a longtime observer or enthusiastic participant of cocktail culture. Whatever your particular situation, chances are you've noticed some significant shifts in the drinks themselves as the years have gone by. I first got serious about craft cocktails more than 20 years ago, and at that time, classic cocktails, ones that had been around for decades or more than a century, and typically composed of relatively few ingredients, were the guiding light. Bartenders learned to perfect these simple recipes and the techniques required to make a simply decent drink into an extraordinary drink, and that was really the name of the game for the early stages of the cocktail renaissance. Today, of course, complexity is everywhere, and I don't want to come off as too jaded about that because the kinds of creativity and innovation we're seeing in bars today is really special. Modern bartenders have many more options and opportunities than their predecessors did even just a decade ago. That said, simplicity still plays a significant role in our cocktail universe. Whether it's for folks making drinks at home or in a bar dedicated to keeping things approachable and keeping things affordable, a keen understanding of the power of simplicity can really benefit bartenders and bar owners as well as their regular guests. If you think about bartenders who might really personify this kind of elevated simplicity like I'm talking about, Eric Castro in San Diego is one of the first people who comes to mind. Eric's been working in bars for many years now, and currently he's the owner of Gilly's House of Cocktails in San Diego and still a proprietor at Raised by Wolves. And he's also the host of the Bartender at Large podcast and active in many, many, many other projects all across the country. Eric's cocktails have always struck me as models of elevated simplicity. They're typically pretty easy to prepare, they're typically composed of ingredients that are pretty easy to find, and they're invariably delicious and the kinds of drinks you find yourself really hankering for in the days after you've had one. So for this episode, I invited Eric Castro to join us to talk about simplicity in cocktails and the benefits to be found in it. And since this is summer and we're all dealing with the heat on one level or another, I'm also pulling Eric into a short conversation about frozen cocktails and the best practices to keep in mind while taking those on at home. Before we get started, a note from this episode's sponsor, Garrison Brothers Distillery, the first legal whiskey distillery outside of Kentucky to produce authentic handmade bourbon whiskey. Celebrate America's favorite classic cocktail, the Old Fashioned, with them the month of September to raise funds for Boot Campaign at participating bars and restaurants across the U.S. Head to highfashioned.com, that's HYEfashioned.com, to learn more. Eric, welcome to Radio Imbibe.
Oh, brother, thank you for having me.
And, you know, this is where everything gets kind of circular, because you and I have known each other for like 16 or 17 years, like since your Rickhouse days. I think that's when I first met you in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And I've interviewed you a number of times over the years for different publications. And at Imbibe, we've had you and your bars, plural, covered a number of times in the magazine, yeah, on the website over the years for one thing or another. And I've been on your podcast, Bartender at Large, a couple of times.
Yeah, a couple of times.
And I finally got you on Radio Imbibe. And let me tell you, I could not be more pleased about this case.
Oh, brother, I'm psyched. I'm psyched to be here, man. You're a good friend of mine. And sometimes it's wild to think about how fast time has gone by, because it doesn't seem like 16 years, but I know it has been.
Yeah, exactly. And I want to talk to you now, you know, in the summer of 2025. And I initially, when I reached out to you, I pitched you on talking about frozen drinks or blender drinks, because I know it's something that you've excelled in over the years, but we're going to get to those in a moment. But I also want to talk to you about your overall approach to cocktails, because there are several reasons I think your approach is really important and really kind of, you know, gripping for people. So before we get to the frozen stuff, you've run a number of bar programs over the years, and simplicity to me has always been kind of like a through.
Yeah.
You know, a certain kind of degree of simplicity in the cocktail construction. Is that fair to say that's kind of a connection in your approach?
Yeah, absolutely. I've always taken a very, very classic approach to cocktails. And I don't think it's coincidence. I think maybe the cocktail I might be most known for is the Pina Verde, and it's like four ingredients. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing I always try to preach to my staff when they're doing cocktail development. I'm like, I tell them it's very easy to make a good drink that has a lot of ingredients. Mm-hmm. But it's really hard to make a great drink that has a lot of ingredients. And that's because to a certain point, every time you add something, you're starting to mask the base spirit. And I feel like any good cocktail, a great cocktail should highlight the base spirit. You know, we're not like college kids making jungle juice. We're crafting cocktails with very, very well-made spirits. And so much of that is like, mm-hmm, when, right, you look at the cocktails that have stood the test of time, whether it's the margarita or the old fashioned or, you know, a south side, a martini, although those are cocktails that showcase the spirit and highlight it. And to me, all the distillers are doing the hardest part of the cocktail, if you really think about it. You know, so much, it's like they're crafting this world-class ingredient that deserves to be treated and considered with respect. And I feel like these classic cocktails, these bartenders, you know, 80 years ago, 100 years ago, they knew what they were doing.
Exactly. And, you know, we're living at a wonderful time for cocktail people, let's be very clear. But at a time when you look at menus from renowned bars and internationally acclaimed bars, and in some ways, on a lot of these menus, there's a tremendous degree of creativity and innovation going on. But there's also kind of an arms race in some ways. You know, it's like a continual escalation of things. Is it a situation where in which the simple three-ingredient or four-ingredient cocktails may not hold as much interest?
I think it's cyclical, and I'm fine with it because a lot of these cocktails are very delightful and fun to drink. But I think it was coming out of the pandemic, we're going in the pandemic, a lot of, you know, we couldn't go to bars, so a lot of people really stepped up their home cocktail game, and they started making Manhattans and margaritas like properly with fresh juices and making really good cocktails at home. So then I think coming out of the pandemic, they were so eager to have cocktails that are too much of a pain in the ass to make themselves at home. So like, you know what? I've been making old fashions and boulevardiers for the last 2 years at home. I want to go have something with chocolate cake that was ran through a rotovap, and rotten blue cheese that was like, you know, fermented and then, you know, flash infused with and distilled into a local gin. That's what they want, honestly. And I get it. I think it's like people wanted a little bit of pizzazz and a little bit of, you know, something to dazzle them. But I would say as fun as it is, I think one of the downsides is now we're having a generation of bartenders that doesn't know how to make cocktails because they're only making 8 drinks that are on their menu and that's it. They don't know how to make anything off menu. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it, it's like we're becoming batch tenders where I've had this experience recently where I've gone to a lot of these world-class bars and like I order some of the drinks off their menu and they're fantastic. They taste wonderful. And then I'll order like a Southside and no one there knows how to make one. And like, oh, we don't have any mint. And I'm like, huh? Like, oh, I just looked it up online and no one knows how to make it. And you're like, this is ridiculous. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's I mean, in a way, it's like any other, you know, this is part of the culinary arts. And it's like any other kind of art form where you need to kind of have that mastery of the basics in order to understand how all of the bells and whistles then start to work together.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I like to tell this story of something that happened recently and kind of blew my mind. You know, I'm not like a doom and gloom guy about it, but I was behind the bar at Gilly's and these three bartenders came and sat in front of me. And, you know, they were like, hey, Eric, we're on time crunch. We just need like 3 quick cocktails. You know, could you make us something sparkling though? We're feeling festive. You know, 3 of the same. Something with, you know, French 75 like twist, whatever. So I was like, okay, cool. So I made them 3 Old Cubans and I put the cocktails in front of them and they were like, oh my God, Eric, these are fantastic. Whoa. Like, what is this?
They are.
And I was like, oh, it's just an Old Cuban, a good, you know, and they were like, looked at each other like, whoa, what's that? Is this one of your cocktails? Did you invent this? And I was like, no, it's an Audrey Saunders cocktail. And they looked at each other and they looked at me and like, who's Audrey Saunders? And that's when I was like, oh, okay. All right, guys. I didn't put on like, you know, my get off my lawn hat or anything. Right. But I was very much like, hey, she's this amazing bartender. You guys should look her up. She's made these incredible cocktails. You know, she used to own Pegu Club, blah, blah. And I kind of went off and saw it as an opportunity to educate rather than like, you know, lecture. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, guys, this is a super simple cocktail. It's really easy to make, great pour cost. Doesn't cost a lot. And it's just like an incredibly delicious and refreshing drink.
And, you know, and this is kind of where I feel like Grandpa Simpson when I'm talking about cocktails. You know, we put elderflower liqueur in everything, as was the fashion back in that day.
Yeah.
But when we look back to the aughts, when folks like Audrey or Sasha Petraska were on the West Coast, we had like Eric Adkins and Thad Vogler. Simplicity was key in a way. And it was all about understanding your ingredients and the technique and putting them together. When you're looking at your menu at Gilly's or if you're training a new staff member, how do you reinforce kind of the importance of not overthinking something or, you know, aim for something that's always going to land solid?
Yeah, guess what it is? It's like I very much enjoy showcasing the base spirit and I don't like the main ingredients to get lost, right? So I always try to tell my staff, whether it's at, you know, Raised by Wolves or back when I was at Play Provisions, is like, strip whatever is non-essential. I always think of that quote, the Michelangelo quote, where someone told him like, oh, how did you sculpt David? And he's like, oh, it's super easy. You know, all I did was I just looked at the marble and I scraped off everything that wasn't David. And it's just like, well, I'm sure it's a little more complicated than that. But it is. It's like you basically have to start to trip the non-essential. So sometimes, when I'm talking to staff members, this doesn't mean we can't have elaborate setups. Like, you know, we'll still do, you know, we still do fat washes and we still do like forced carbonation and, you know, clarification, all that stuff. But even then, even though we're using complicated processes, it's always with simple approaches. And I think that there's a miscommunication. A lot of times people think simple and simplistic are the same thing. They are not, right? Like a vodka Red Bull is a simplistic cocktail, right? it's there to serve a utilitarian purpose, right? Whereas opposed to other approaches, it's like, you know, I would say, but an old fashioned or a Negroni is very simple, not simplistic by any stretch of the imagination, because there's so much complexity there, and you're only able to achieve that by fully understanding the ingredients. And there's a reason why I think the old fashioned and, you know, to some extent the daiquiri as well, are two drinks that people use to, like, you know, measure the skill of a bartender, is that's because there's nowhere to hide.
Right.
You either know what you're doing or you don't. It's like, it reminds you of, like, you know, when you hear about chefs, I don't know how often this actually happens. It might be more apocryphal than it is, like, you know, pervasive. But, and that's when people, you know, they'll apply it to work in the kitchen and the chef will say, fry me an egg. And that's when the applicant will get really scared. Like, oh crap. Like, are you sure I can make you my mom's famous clam chowder? Like, no, I want you to fry me an egg. Because it's like, you need to understand temperature. You need to understand everything. You need to understand technique, because there is nowhere to hide. So I do feel like with those cocktails, it's really like revealing about the bartender and their approach to a cocktail.
Right, right. You mentioned Gilly's, and I want to talk about Gilly's for a little bit, because the simplicity also, when we're talking simplicity, we're also meaning approachability. Like you mentioned the old Cuban earlier, and like somebody who's never encountered the old Cuban before, put it in front of them. Oh my God, this is a delicious drink. And just like everything just functions so well. And that kind of simplicity and approachability as a cocktail is kind of like the through line for the menu you have at Gilly's. And here I'm thinking of drinks like the Kentucky Buck, which is a Eric Castro original that we at Imbibe dubbed the modern classic cocktail 10 years ago. And the Pale Rider, which we just ran the recipe for that in our May, June issue of the magazine.
How
do you walk that line today in 2025? And this goes back to your earlier point, when people are accustomed to seeing things like foams or pearls on top of a drink. And this is more for like your guests when they come in, how do you present this to them to be like, okay, you know what? I don't have the bells and whistles. What I do have is something that is absolutely delicious and you're going to want to come back and have it over and over again.
I'm going to say something and I hope this doesn't come out wrong, because I'm one of those people, like my two bars in San Diego, Raised by Wolves is a very elaborate, intricate form of service. And it works there because Raised by Wolves is more like a special occasion bar, you know, right, where people pop in. You know, some people, we have regulars that come in once a week, of course, who, you know, work in the neighborhood. But mostly we have folks coming in. It's for like, you know, for date nights, before, after dinner. It's more of like a treat, I guess, an approach, right? And it works very well within that format, because we're not surrounded by tons and tons of housing. It's more of like a mixed use, mixed commercial and residential use. Whereas Gilly's is heavily residential. We are a neighborhood bar. We have regulars who come in. Our regulars generally come in three times a week, 3 to 5 times a week. So the thing is, a lot of these really intricate cocktails with the, you know, boba bubbles and very, very elaborate serves, I wouldn't go to those bars 2 or 3 times a week, right? That style of cocktail doesn't lend itself to multiple servings throughout the week, multiple visits.
Yeah, it can't be a part of your regular. It's a sometimes.
No,
food.
It's more. Yeah. I mean, I would get sick of them by then, right? You get sick of it by then. So the thing is, the approach to Gilly's is like, our cocktails have to be delicious, have to be inventive, have to have, you know, some sense of novel appeal. But more importantly, you have to be able to drink them a few times a week.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we do have a lot of regulars. I feel like our regulars are our bread and butter in that location, you know?
Right.
And also people are hanging out, they're socializing, they're shooting pool, they're playing darts, you know, maybe, you know, playing a little bit of Ms. Pac-Man. So because of that, our cocktails have to be able to be drank over the course of an afternoon or an evening. So, you know, they can't just all be haymakers. Basically, yeah, we have a lot of fun doing that menu. And we also lean a lot into classics. Our staff is very, very versed in classics, which back in the, I feel like a few years back, was not anything special, but nowadays it's like a novelty in the bar world. Like, well, this guy knows how to make a planner's brunch. It's weird. It is a strange thing. So, yeah, so a lot of our cocktails, when I look at some of our top seven cocktails, you know, it's like, it's mezcal with hibiscus and orange bitters, Irish whiskey and coconut. They're inventive flavor combinations, but in a way that's very refreshing and very, I don't want to say sessionable, but yeah, very sessionable. You know, you can kind of hang out. And then you can also rotate between them. You know, you can come in, have a Negroni. Then you switch, like, you know, have, you know, Tommy's Margarita, and then you switch to a beer. You know, our staff is just there to take care of you and provide something delicious regardless of what mood you're in.
Right, right. And we've talked about kind of the appeal of this style of cocktail for the customers, for the guests coming in. But for you as a bar owner, they also matter as well, because here we're also talking about cost. And I know this is a big issue for you. And really to all
especially
bar owners.
Right now.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we live in a world that's kind of dominated by inflation, in a very inflationary environment. And so this is something you have to keep it in your head, that cost component, in line for these times. How do you do that? And how does this kind of program play into supporting you as an owner?
Oh, I mean, it comes back to what I was just saying, and things, it's like a lot of these bars that people are going to nowadays, right? I do feel like out of the pandemic, I feel like a lot of places start going crazy with their prices. And maybe I think it is a little bit about, you know, like, well, we need to start offering people stuff that they can't make at home, you know? So let's give them something like really interesting, or this really cool bottle that's kind of hard to find. But next thing you know, the prices on all of these cocktails just start skyrocketing. I would say, I don't think the quality of these cocktails was skyrocketing at that same level. It's one thing to pay $22 for a delicious, well-made cocktail. It's something else to pay $22 for a cocktail that's like not even all that great. And then you kind of just feel fleeced and you feel cheated over it, right? It's like, One thing, to bring it back to Gilly's, is that Gilly's, like I said, we have a lot of regulars. We're in a heavily residential neighborhood. So we have a lot of people who come in 2-3 times a week, you know, sometimes 5 days a week. And because of that, who can afford to drink $22 cocktails all week? Right. Not me. Not me. Yeah. And I think it's like, we want to make sure people don't get sticker shock. So we legitimately put a lot of time and effort into making sure that our cocktails are approachable and friendly to your wallet. And we're very lucky in the sense that we don't have a kitchen. You know, we have a full liquor license, but we don't really have food or anything besides like potato chips and beef jerky that we sell at the bar top. So because of that, I don't have preps to pay. I don't have a sommelier to pay. I don't have, you know, a host desk to manage. It's really just bartenders, barbacks, and, you know, security guard. So because of that, our labor's low, so it allows us to price our cocktails accordingly. And because of that, I think in where the economy is today, our clientele appreciates that. And like, oh, this place is cool. The drinks are great. Shoot a little bit of pool, you know, hang out with other locals, meet people in the neighborhood. And it's like, it doesn't break the bank, you know? And even if like, you know, our cocktails are at $13, you know, but then we have a great happy hour menu. It's at 8:00. And on Monday nights, we do all night happy hour. So people can come in and socialize, have some delicious drinks, and never really feel like they're being taken advantage of or you know, cheated regards to prices.
And for bar owners or for folks opening up bars, this is a time, you know, we have no idea when our economic situation is going to change, when the pressure may come off of inflation. So for folks looking to start a place or to create a program or putting together a program for a client in the year or the next couple of years ahead, what kinds of things are helpful to kind of internalize in your thinking about that program to keep those costs in line while still providing something really cool for the guests coming in?
I would say a lot of it is basically just, you really have to know your ingredients. You have to be really in touch with your ingredients, because there are a lot of ingredients out there that convey value that aren't expensive. You know, like pandan, you know, is a great example. Where pandan, most people don't have that around the house. Most people don't even know where to buy it. But it's one of those things, if you make a pandan syrup and then you add, you know, just something like Beefeater gin or an ingredient that's kind of fairly inexpensive, people don't mind paying a little bit more for that, because like, well, I don't have that ingredient around the house, and then it's a few dashes of rosemary bitters. I don't have rosemary bitters either. So when people see inventive additives and flavors that they might not have around the house, it does convey value, even if these ingredients aren't expensive. Or if you have a cocktail with muddled mandarins or something, mandarins again or something, when they're in season, they're very cheap. But they communicate a value proposition that people don't feel cheated or being ripped off for, right? There's a lot of teas. I think a lot of teas are like that. A lot of herbs, other botanicals, even some like really cool Amaro ingredients. So it's important to learn these ingredients and familiarize yourself with them. So then you and your staff can provide your clientele with something a little bit better tasting, a little more inventive than they would make at home, but at the same time, you know, still allows you to give them something delicious at a good price.
Right, right. And it ties into what we were talking about earlier, where this is part of the culinary arts, and this gives you an opportunity to kind of engage with that without, you know, having to buy a Rotovap or a Spinzol or something like that.
No, absolutely. And I think that if when you look at a lot of like, you know, regional cuisines that are done really, really well, I think those will also fall in line with place like this. Like if you're in the South and you go have fried chicken, it's generally not super expensive, right? But the thing is, people can still go there and eat it because, like, man, the way they're processed, they make it. I'm not making it like that at home. Or at least it's me from Southern California. I'm like, you know, where they soak it, inject it with buttermilk. And I'm like, I'm not doing all that stuff. So, you know, you can have some of these foods. Barbecue's another thing like that, right? Like, I don't have a cooker. I'm not going to slow cook something, barbecue something for 8 hours overnight. So I pay a little bit extra for that, even though I know it's like it doesn't necessarily cost a lot of money. But it's more about the process. So that's why I like doing syrups, infusions, fat washes, a lot of these low-cost approaches to add flavor, inject flavor into cocktails. But maybe the consumer wouldn't do that at home because it's like it just seems like a pain for them, right? So, and also, here's the thing. When someone tells me, oh, I had a cocktail that was amazing, and I'm like, well, it was $25. It should be amazing. You can't even really brag about that. Like, oh, our drinks are so good. I'm like, well, I mean, $25, they better knock my socks off. Otherwise, it's a ripoff. I remember I heard a quote, a friend of mine, he said he worked at this nice steakhouse and he asked the guest, like, oh, hey, so you didn't mention your steak. How was the food? And the guy's like, oh, it was incredible. Like, you didn't say anything. He's like, well, the steak was $125. It should be incredible.
Yeah.
Like, what I mean by that is it's so hard to over deliver. But when someone's buying, you know, an $8 cocktail at happy hour and, you know, and they're like, damn, this is good. Like, really good. You're like, yeah, like, for $8, like, it's honest, when we first took over the space, because Gilly's going to be 20 years old next year, and when we first took it over, I remember people being, like, a lot of customers were freaking out, like, hey, I don't get it. I'm like, what do you mean? Like, do you work here? And I'm like, yeah. Like, so this cocktail, I ordered an espresso martini, and it's outstanding. And it's $8, and then my girlfriend, she had a Negroni, and the bartender asked what if she had a preference in gin. I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Like, but this place looks like a janky little dive bar. Like, why are the drinks so good? I'm like, well, we just like to over-deliver. We want to make sure, you know, everybody's having something good.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, I approached you for this episode to talk about frozen drinks. And we found other things that we thought were really fascinating to get into, and I'm glad we did. But we should come back to it at some point because it's July. It's hot as hell out there.
Yeah.
People are roasting all summer long. And there's an awesome appeal about putting your booze in a blender with a bunch of ice. There was a time when cocktail nerds like me used to be sniffy about frozen drinks after all those crappy frozen margaritas from the 90s and so on. What was the convincer frozen cocktail for you? What was the one where you said, okay, you know what? These don't all have to be crap.
You know, I would say what really convinced me was like a lot of the tiki bars. We're lucky. I was lucky. I kind of came, you know, of age in the craft cocktail scene, at least in the Bay Area. And in San Francisco, particular, such a strong, there was always such a strong tiki presence. And craft tiki presence is what I mean. So I just always felt like the tiki guys understood the appeal of a delicious, cold, frosty cocktail. And I remember having Mai Tais, you know, at before Smuggler's Cove. Remember when Martin Kate used to be at Forbidden Island?
Forbidden right? Island in Alameda. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember the first time I had a proper, well-made Mai Tai, which is like, it was like less of a cocktail, more of a revelation. Mm-hmm. Where it's just like, you know, he did a flash blender with the crushed ice. I mean, it's super frosty. You pour it in the glass and instantly the outside of the glass just frosts up and you get that like nice icy sheen on the outside of the cocktail. And I was like, okay, this is what a good like frozen cocktail is supposed to taste like. And granted, this isn't in the blender, but it you know, the appeal is much the same. It's just like frosty, ice cold, crushed ice, a spent lime garnish, and a big fat mint sprig on top. Right. And it was just, this is heaven.
I think all of that is appealed to me, but also, you know, a number of years ago when I went to Cuba and I went to El Floridita, you know, the cradle of the daiquiri.
Yeah.
And, you know, they are running their blenders all day and all night long in that bar, just churning out one frozen daiquiri, one frozen rum drink after another for good reason. I mean, Cuba is hot and it's never not hot there. So it's kind of a survival mechanism, but you can see this kind of beautiful balance. You can get nuance, you can get delicate components while still it's a big slushy glass of a frozen drink. So, you know, obviously a lot of bars today, American bars, use frozen drink machines to make frozen drinks because it's convenient, it's more easy.
Yeah.
You can do it on a larger scale. That said, for folks listening at home, what are some best practices for approaching frozen drinks like the ones you mentioned or others out there? Are there things that are really helpful to keep in mind?
There are two that I can really think of. You know, you could use a traditional blender. You want to have a good blender. I mean, not saying everybody has to go buy, like, you know, $400 Vitamix, but I even kind of like how some of the cheaper blenders will still leave a little bit, they'll leave it a little chunky. I actually kind of like that, especially for margaritas. Some people obviously like to have like the, they like it to be velvety smooth, right? Like, you know, I feel like a lot of like the Cuban bars will do that, and it's delicious. I still enjoy the appeal of like a chunky margarita, like, you know, out of the blender. Here's a little tip I like to share with people is like, you, if you have a Sonic or like a Coffee Bean in your town, they sell their Pebble Ice. And you can go in there, you can go to Sonic and be like, oh, hey, I'll take 10 pounds of your Pebble Ice, and they'll sell it to you. And that stuff makes great, great frozen cocktails because you can make Mai Tais out of it, but you can also put in a blender and it blends really nice. I have like a, I have a crushed ice maker at home that I bought off of, you know, online for probably like $40, which is great. Also good for frozen cocktails. Another thing, if you do really want to lean to this, I'd recommend getting a Hamilton Beach blender, the ones all the tiki bars use.
One of those like the top blenders.
Yeah, kind of the spindle blender. Yeah. Those things are amazing. Yeah. Those things, we have McGillies, we use them all the time. And, like, we have a lot of tiki pop-ups. And it's funny, they always love, like, oh, but you don't really see these in, like, non-tiki bars. I'm like, no, man, I love them. They're great. And they, you know, because we saw a fair amount of Mai Tais and stuff like that. So, and one other thing I would say, like, I think, I know sugar sometimes gets a bad rap in a lot of in a lot of drinks. But the thing is, you have to add a little bit of extra sugar to your frozen cocktails. And I think that sometimes people are shocked by that, you know, because they'll try to make one at home. Like, oh, it's just really, like, acidic. I don't understand why it's not as good as the ones I have at the bar. That's because extreme temperatures, well, I guess extreme for you know, food and drink, will inhibit sweetness. So when something's really cold, it'll kind of shock your palate a little bit. So it's hard to perceive sweetness. That's why, you know, room temperature ice cream, when you let it melt, it tastes so much sweeter. But when it's you know, straight out of the freezer, it doesn't seem like that. So go ahead and add like an extra, you know, extra quarter ounce or half ounce of, you know, simple syrup,
right,
or sweetening agent to your frozen cocktail.
It's also a textural thing too, just that kind of unctuous quality on your palate.
It
you
does.
Know, when you have that slushy aspect, it kind of gives it a little bit more body in a way,
mm-hmm.
and so it just feels heavier. One thing also, I hadn't even thought of this when I was talking to you, and then you brought it up with talking about Forbidden Island. Strong flavors function pretty well in frozen cocktails. We're thinking like, you know, big potently flavored liqueurs, you know, coffee, things with those big kind of potent flavors, because you're thinning it out with that extra ice. But
that water,
but it still like gives that good punch of flavor on the palate.
Mm-hmm. That's why I think when you see a lot of, you know, I guess a lot of the tropical cocktails, you know, even some of the proto tiki cocktails, a lot of those that were like served frozen, right? It's like a lot of them have like very big aggressive flavors. Like it'll be two sweeteners. It'll be like grenadine with orgeat, Jamaican rum, overproof rum, mint, lemon, orange juice. There's a lot of ingredients in there because it's like when it gets that cold, it's you know, the aggressiveness of the flavors actually kind of complement the overall, I guess, final product of the cocktail.
Eric, thank you so much for being on the podcast and for sharing all of this with us. And I am badly overdue for a trip to San Diego, and I need to come down and see you again.
Brother, I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much for having me, man. And we look forward to having you back in San Diego soon.
Cheers.
Cheers.
You can find Eric Castro online at bartenderatlarge.com. And Eric's also on Instagram at HungryBartender. We've got those links for you in this episode's notes. Thanks again to this episode's sponsor, Garrison Brothers Distillery. And that's it for this episode. Be sure to subscribe to Radio Imbibe on your favorite podcast app to keep up with all our future episodes. We've got plenty of drink recipes, articles, and more for you on our website at imbibemagazine.com. Keep up with our day-to-day exploits on Instagram, Pinterest, Facebook, and Threads for all your social media needs. And if you're not already a subscriber to the print and or digital issues of Imbibe, then let's get you on the team. Just follow the link in this episode's notes, and we'll be happy to help you out. I'm Paul Clark. This is Radio Imbibe. Catch you next time.